From WVUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For decades, Israeli TV viewers have heard the news of the day from anchorman of Israel's Channel 1 News, Haim Yavin. Yavin is 72 now and a national institution. He's been called the voice of Israel, the soul of Israel. So well known, he's called Mr. TV. Now, this revered journalist, always perceived as nonpartisan, has shocked his country by making a personal documentary film expressing his own views, a despairing film that scathingly condemns Israel's settlement policy in the occupied territories of the Palestinians. Tonight on Point, Israeli TV institution Haim Yavin and his controversial film about the most loaded issue in the life of Israel. But first, we begin tonight with news from Israel, where tensions are mounting between police and thousands of protesters gathered outside the village of Kfar Maimon, just 10 miles from the Gaza Strip. Thousands of Israelis have gathered in an attempt to march to Gaza in support of settlers there, who have been ordered by the government of Ariel Sharon to leave their settlements or be moved by force on August 15th. Israeli police today declared the march illegal and cordoned off the demonstrators, trying to prevent them from moving any closer to the border. Joining me now from Tel Aviv is Dina Kraft, who was in Kfar Maimon today and is covering the protests for the New York Times. Dina, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Dina, can you describe the scene in Kfar Maimon today as the protesters there in support of the settlers confronted police?
Yeah, most of the day was actually started off quite quietly with people sleeping under trees and on sleeping bags trying to get some rest after a long night the night before. And then later in the afternoon, there were some clashes as the police began to cordon off the entire village, creating human walls at the entrance and all around the farming village. And there were some scuffles, and about six people were lightly injured, including policemen.
Tell us about the agenda of each side here. First, the protesters who are gathering there. What would they like to do? Why are they there?
Yeah, the protesters are basically fighting for what they call their last stand. They're trying to show the government that the planned withdrawal from the Gaza Strip and the Northern West Bank will not pass quietly. They believe this is their biblical birthright to live there, and that this is as part of the beginning of a very dangerous precedent if land is given back. And they say it's also a concession to terrorism. They say the Palestinians have given them nothing but violence and fighting the last 4.5 years since the Intifada began. And this is not what should be happening, a unilateral withdrawal from Gaza. And they're very upset, and they feel like they need to come out in force and in numbers, and they were clad in their colors of orange. Orange has become the color of their protest movement. And the village was a virtual sea of orange today, people in orange T-shirts, eating orange popsicles, floating orange balloons. And people were hot and restless. Temperatures were up into the 90s, and they're angry, and they want to get along on the road to Gaza.
Is there any sign that the government of Ariel Sharon is going to take the protest into account, or is it determined to move ahead with the Gaza pullout?
He is absolutely 100% determined to go forward and has repeatedly said that no kind of protest, civil or unviolent otherwise, will stop him, that this is for the good of the country. There was a historical mistake by putting the settlements in Gaza, and now it's time to leave.
How many settlers will be removed from the Gaza Strip, and I guess a few from the West Bank as well? What's scheduled?
Yeah, it's about 8,500 settlers in the Gaza Strip, and a few hundred more in the northern West Bank. Two of the four northern West Bank settlements are pretty much empty. They were settled by secular Jews, and most have left on their own volition. And there are two other settlements where actually lots of young religious families have recently been moving in and fortifying and creating tent camps within the settlements in a hope to fortify them and make it even more difficult to withdraw from those settlements as well.
Dina, who are the Israelis who are gathering in support of the settlers in the Gaza Strip, and do they have a chance at breaking through the police cordons there?
They are from all over the country, but I would say a big majority of them are for other settlers from the West Bank who want to show solidarity. But I met people today from Jerusalem and from Ra'anana, from towns inside Israel as well. And an unprecedented show of force, the Israeli police yesterday decided to block the marchers from even getting to their central gathering point last night by actually going into buses and telling bus drivers that they would have their licenses removed if they continued to drive their buses towards the site of the demonstration. But yet they arrived by hitchhiking, by foot, and private taxi. They're quite determined to get there, and they're very organized. As far as the chances of them breaking through the police and army coordinates, it'll be difficult for them. I mean, as it is, it's a wall of police and soldiers outside. There are tens of thousands throughout the country also blocked off at roadblocks along the way. So even if some succeed to sort of get in out here or there, they'll be blocked at other roadblocks. And the instruction to block them at all costs has come directly from the defense minister himself, saying it should they be allowed out of this village and allowed on their way to the Gaza Strip.
And finally, Dina, Condoleezza Rice, U.S. Secretary of State, is making an previously unscheduled visit to Israel this week in support of the Gaza pullout and keeping peace between Israelis and Palestinians in the weeks before that. Is that visit seen as important? Are people talking about it in the little town of Kfar Maimon?
People aren't really talking about it. They feel like the Americans are far away, and if they see the Americans as any role, they see it as negative now. They look at Sharon as a pawn of the Americans. They think he does George Bush's bidding, and they have lost all of their respect for him. This was a man who actually led the settler movement in past years and now has done a complete 180-degree switch and has decided to be the first prime minister to remove them from their homes. If anything, they look down on Condoleezza Rice's visit and see it as more proof that Sharon is just doing the American administration's bidding.
And that scheduled removal coming closer by the day. Dina Kraft, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Dina Kraft, a reporter for the New York Times. She joined me from Tel Aviv. As the longtime face of the evening TV news, Haim Yavin is a fixture in Israeli life, a kind of Walter Cronkite or Tom Brokaw to Israel. But over the last few weeks, Israeli audiences have seen a different side of Mr. Yavin, with the airing of a very personal documentary series specifically condemning the impact of thousands of Israeli settlers in the occupied territories. Reaction in Israel has been one of shock, from some cheers and from some rage. Tonight on Point, Israeli TV anchor Haim Yavin and his sorrowing report on Israel's settler movement. Haim Yavin joins me now from Tel Aviv. Since 1968, he's been a pillar of Israel's Channel 1, the country's state-run television station. 2 years ago, he took a small video camera and began to film in the Israeli settlements and Palestinian communities of the West Bank and Gaza. What he found disturbed him deeply. Haim Yavin, welcome and good evening. Thanks for joining us.
Good evening, Tom.
So here you are. You're 72 years old, and you're heading out with a handheld video camera into some very tough territory and coming back with a very tough message for your fellow Israelis. You say in your documentary, since 1967, we have been brutal conquerors, occupiers, suppressing other people. We simply don't view the Palestinians as human beings. Haim Yavin, at your age, I guess you were about 70 then, what put you out in the midst of this high-tension scene on the West Bank with a little handheld video camera? What took you there? Why?
Well, to be brief about that, I think it was the Intifada, but I've been busy with the Palestinian-Israeli problem ever since I think I started with the news, and more specifically after the Oslo Agreement, which is 10 years ago. But I've been with the picture, with the problem, ever since we started television, and even before that on radio. I think the Yom Kippur War started my concern about where are we heading. And I think this came to a climax in the Intifada. And then I went to cover a good story, you know. Mm-hmm. But then I got so involved mentally, physically, in the story that I decided to make a personal journey log, if you want, telling this as in first person, as I saw it, as I felt it, as I talked to people.
And you end up concluding, you say in the documentary, I'm telling you what we're doing is not Jewish. What do you mean by that, Haim Yavin?
Well, I think this was said in connection with a rabbi that supervises or sees or stands aside and walks one and looks at one of the roadblocks, which are a very sorrow sight. You know, because of the security problems of Israel, we have a lot of roadblocks on the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip, trying to catch the terrorists before they enter Israel. But the Palestinians in their masses are obliged to stand in line in very bad conditions in the hot sun or in the rain, and to wait hours until their turn comes to cross the roadblock. And sometimes they are abused, Not always, thank God, but sometimes they are abused and even worse than that. And I stand there with a rabbi who is the rabbi of the Itamar outpost or settlement, not far from Nablus, and right in the middle of Judea. And I'm speaking to him, and I'm telling him, look at the suffering of those people. I'm trying to see where do you see the terrorists? The women with their little children in their arms. Do you see the terrorists here? Of course, I know very well that a lot of times people have smuggled arms and ammunition through these blocks with ambulances, with pregnant women, and so on and so forth. But the mass, you know, the crowd there stands hours on end and waits for their turn to cross the roadblocks. And I'm telling him, listen, this suffering of these people, this is not Jewish to do that. Jewish tradition is a moral tradition. We have a moral ethos, and we have to respect that. And we came into this land, Zionism came into this land to build here a new country for an old people based on the principles of ethical morals. And this is, in my opinion, a terrible thing that's happening to us.
In the settlements in the West Bank, in Gaza, and of course, things changing there right now. We'll come back and ask just how much they're changing. Chaim Yavin is with us tonight, Israel's Mr. Television. He's taken his camera into the settlement areas of the West Bank and come back with a disturbing documentary, Diary of a Journey, Land of the Settlers. Chaim Yavin, please stand by. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Chaim Yavin. He is anchor of Mabat, the main evening news on Channel 1, Israeli state television. Has been there since 1968, the voice of Israeli television, who came out just a couple of months ago now with a new very personal documentary on the Israeli settlements and settlers in the West Bank, a bit of Gaza there as well, which has been a huge rock in the pond in Israel. Been compared to Walter Cronkite coming out in the late 60s against the war in Vietnam. Mr. Yavin says, no, I don't have that kind of sway. But we wonder, Chaim Yavin, the long tour that you take here, and it must have been over many, many months with your camera, presents so many pictures, so many images, so many situations, many of them disturbing. Lots of Americans won't really know what it is that you found. To the extent you can put it in a nutshell, what is the problem with the settlements fundamentally as you see it?
You know, I say in this series that some of my friends on the left, on the radical left, but also on the left in general, don't like, even hate the settlers. I don't hate them. Mm. I even like them.
That's clear
in the documentary. I appreciate
what they're
doing. Mm-hmm. But I'm saying this. Mm-hmm. But I think they are wrong, and they're endangering us. It is because they are idealists, because they are religious people. This is the main danger. They believe that the whole land was given only to us. And they, I think, because of the security problems that we have, because of the terrorist attacks that we suffer from, and this is a very, very serious and very, very grievous thing, in my opinion, they have lost all trust in the Palestinians, and I think they are not willing to even regard them as a people. You see, I think we have to differentiate between the terrorists and the Palestinian people as a whole, and we have to compromise. And they are not willing to compromise. And there lies the main danger. Now, when we see the disengagement, the Sharon plan of pulling out of Gaza, they know that if we pull out of Gaza, Hebron and the West Bank are in danger of pulling out of there as well. And this is why they're putting up such a fight. And I think there's no way to get peace to our region unless and until we accept the idea of compromise. They are not willing to accept that, and therein lies this danger of never having peace and having the situation get worse and worse.
You take your camera into the homes of settlers, into confrontations between Israelis and Palestinians, Palestinians doing their farming, Israeli settlers looking to maintain some security around their lives, and you bring back disturbing images, disturbing bits of conversation, an Israeli couple saying that the Palestinians should simply be driven out of the West Bank, and if they won't flee, if they won't be driven out, kind of ethnically cleansed, they should be bombed, they should be killed. They said, America did it in Iraq, why can't we do it here? You film graffiti on the wall saying, Arabs to the crematoria. And you quote an Israeli soldier saying, since 1967, we've established a slave camp here. He calls it a crime. And yet there have been many acts of terror against Israelis, many crimes from the other side as well. Where do you find the balance here, Chaim Yavin? And is the balance the issue?
First of all, I would like to make a remark here.
Please.
You know, those people that you mentioned in the beginning of your question are people of the extreme radical right. These are people who are really out of the camp, so to say, even by the settlers. I don't think that they represent the settlers. They represent the right-wingers of the settlers, who are also right-wingers. So this is not a measure of the general body of the settlers. I don't think they are made of such stuff. I think the balance, I make a link between the settlements, the occupation, and the terrorist acts. By no way can the suicide terrorism be condoned or even understood. I think there is no forgiveness, there is no understanding to someone who commits suicide, who gets into a bus, who gets into a restaurant or in a cafe in Tel Aviv and commits suicide and killing children, women, innocent people. There's no forgiveness for that. This is number one. But I think that when you try to see the route or the only way that we have left to get a settlement, I repeat, we have to compromise. And I think the settlements are the obstacle of any peace agreement that we can eventually perhaps reach with the Palestinians. I don't know any other way. They are not going to go away from here. We are not going to go away from here. We are doomed, so to say, to be neighbors, to live on this small piece of land together, side by side. And the only way to do that is to compromise. The roadmap speaks about two states for two nations. This is exactly what we should do. But unless and until we, the people, not only the leaders, but the people themselves, both Palestinians and Israelis, unless we understand, unless we put it into our minds and souls that we have to compromise, and I don't think that most people understand that in depth, unless we do understand this in the bottom of our hearts, we will get nowhere. More bloodshed, more war.
Do you say in the film, though, you say, I call it a Greek tragedy because I don't see any solution. The settlers are so strong in a way, you say, Chaim Yavin, they run the country or run the agenda of the country. Is that still true today as Ariel Sharon appears to be confronting the settler agenda in Gaza, at least?
Well, this is one try by Sharon, who is the patron of the settlements and of the settlers, who really brought them to settle in, on the West Bank. He was, if you want, the prophet of the settlements. He preached for the settlements. But now for the first time, I think, they are confronted. I'm not sure it's the first time, but they are confronted with someone who created them, telling them, hey, enough is enough. Get out of there. We have nothing to look for in the Gaza Strip. We have to evacuate. He promised to have the last Jew out of the Gaza Strip until the end of the year. And this is the first time that someone as powerful as Sharon says to the settlers that they have to adhere to an evacuation decision and law by the parliament. And they are now struggling against this decision by the Knesset, by the parliament, by the government, and you see what they do in Kfar Maimon, and it's just the beginning of their struggle against the disengagement.
Chaim Yavin, there's clearly a disconnect here deep within the Israeli community. And you captured on your film when you have Israeli opponents of the occupation at checkpoints and elsewhere in fiery arguments with the settlers, the opponents saying, you're ruining our future. You're spending all our money to keep you out here. You're forcing our sons to come out and defend you. Why are you doing this? The settlers pushing back and saying, this is our land. This is promised to us by God. How did you find yourself in the middle of that disconnect? How do you understand it? When you showed up, you're compared to Walter Cronkite in the United States. And from the response you get, I can see that. Everybody knows you by your first name, whether you've ever met them or not. The settlers greet you. Chaim, they're surprised to see you there. How do you understand that disconnect at the heart of Israeli society over the settler issue?
I'm just doing what I believe is right to do.
But why is it that Israelis can stare at each other with such lack of understanding, one side for the other?
It's not exactly that. I must explain, give you some background. You see, the reason I'm not blaming the settlers is that, in a way, and I'm saying this, of course, just as a figure of speech, in a way we are all settlers. In the Six-Day War, and I was a soldier then, I was a reporter soldier, we were threatened. I have lived in all my life in this country. We have been threatened time and again to be thrown into the sea. This is a real threat. We are surrounded by millions of Arabs who do not want us here, who have not recognized our right to create a Jewish state in the land of Israel. And the danger is real, you know? In the Six-Day War, I remember those days. This is 40 years ago. We were really in real danger, and all of a sudden you get this, you have this tremendous victory in a war of 6 days.
Yes.
And suddenly you liberate the land of your forefathers, the Western Wall, and those places from the Bible. And you feel as though Messiah has arrived. That you can resettle your land, the land of your forefathers. And everybody is enthusiastic. And everybody goes there and everybody feels, hey, it's going to be okay. We're going to settle there. But all of a sudden, you see that it's an impossibility. This is not an empty land. This is a land where a people live. And things develop. And during the years, more and more Israelis, secular mostly, but not only, there are also religious and Orthodox Jews who recognize that. We have to recognize that the situation has changed, and this is the divide between two camps in Israel, north and the south, if you want. You know, those who think that we have to settle, that we have to compromise against those who said, go away. They are threatening to kill us, and we have to hold, and we have to hold to ours, and there's no room for two nations in this land. They are welcome to live amongst us, but this is going to be the land of Israel. And those people don't realize what it means to have in the midst of you 3.5 million Palestinians who will have no rights. What are we going to be here? South Africa? Are we going to lose the majority? Are we going to rule in a method of the apartheid? This is not our nature. This is an impossibility. This endangers the very possibility, the very future of a Jewish state. We want in Israel a Jewish democratic state. The only thing is to have a Jewish state, is to have a democracy, is to have a majority of Jews in half of the land of Israel. And this is why people are so divided.
Mr. Yavin, you've been around a long time. You've seen a lot. Do you trust that if, and it's a long shot, perhaps impossible, but if Israeli pulled out of all the settlements, do you trust that the Palestinians would turn to domestic life and families and jobs and making a living and give up on the effort, as you say, to push Israel into the sea?
Nobody can predict. Nobody is a prophet. But I believe, and I don't think that we can, we cannot predict and we cannot plan, really, the end result of this conflict. This is why I think that President Bush and Ariel Sharon whom I don't necessarily agree to their way of thinking, but in this respect, I think they think right. We have to think about a way to control the crisis and to move it onto lines of a dynamism that will be a dynamism leading towards peace. You see, it's a question of dynamism, of momentum, we used to call it, of a momentum that can lead either to war, to escalation, or in another way or path, if you want, that will slowly and step by step lead to peace, to a peaceful coexistence, to a ceasefire, and then to more and more ways and more pragmatic steps leading towards peace. I don't think that you can predict today what's going to happen in 10 or 20 years, not in this region. And this is why I think that if you think back, the visit of Sadat, try to think only of that. The fruits that he brought with him, although we don't have a warm peace coexistence with the Egyptians, but we have had for over, 30 years, no war, which is an enormous thing in this area. The same goes for Lebanon. We pulled out of Lebanon. We have peace now. We have quiet, at least. We don't have peace. Sorry. We have quiet on the northern border. It's not going to be an easy way, but I think that the answer is step by step, a roadmap, and then on and on and on, a dynamism leading to peace.
There have been different interpretations of Prime Minister Sharon's initiative in the Gaza Strip, some seeing it as a step on that road to peace, to a two-state solution, others, skeptics, I guess, saying what they expect here is, yes, a pullout from Gaza, but then a hardening of Israeli settlements in the West Bank. How do you perceive what the Prime Minister is up to here? Do you see it as a step toward a two-state solution, peace, a pullout?
There's no place for interpretation here. I think Sharon said this himself. In his last visit and meeting with President Bush, he said so specifically that the blocks of settlements on the West Bank are going to stay there forever and forever. But I think that there are some things that are stronger than even Sharon. And I spoke about that, calling it dynamism. Mm. This is, so to say, a way that not even Sharon can stop. Because if you see what happened to previous prime ministers, they didn't want to give back Hebron. They didn't want to pull out of Lebanon. They didn't want to regard the Oslo agreements. Sharon was one of the people who was against the Oslo agreement, but I think the pullout of Gaza is a son or a grandson of the Oslo agreements. Mm. What's happening, we're getting out of there.
Yeah.
So I think that although Sharon wants us to stay on the West Bank, to keep the settlements, I think that we are going to have to come to an understanding with the Palestinians, not with the Americans, with the Palestinians, about a coexistence. There's going to be a lot of bloodshed on the road. It's not going to be simple, and God forbid we're going to lose a lot of people. They are going to lose a lot of people. It's going to be a road covered with blood. But I think in the end there will be no other way.
You've made a huge noise with this documentary series. Many have called for your resignation. Some have called you anti-Semitic. Some have questioned whether or not a journalist has any business making such a personal report on the situation on the ground. How do you respond to all that criticism?
Well, anti-Semitism I haven't heard yet, but, you know, there's news every day. So I've been attacked, but I've been also covered with a lot of interest and a lot of people who congratulated me on having, they say, courage. I don't see it as any courage. I just, reported what I saw, what I felt, and my convictions. And I think I did the right thing, and I don't regret for a second. Some people have called for my resignation. They stopped calling that. I continue for the time being with the First Channel, doing the anchoring of the news every night. Yesterday I anchored the special program on the disengagement. Mm. And I feel fine with myself. That's the only thing that a reporter should do.
Well, we feel the passion and the honesty in every frame of this documentary, and we're grateful to you for making it, grateful to you for joining us tonight. Chaim Yavin with Channel 1, Israeli State Television. The new documentary is Land of the Settlers. Thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Tom, and thank you for having me on your program.
We've been talking with Chaim Yavin, Israel's Mr. Television, about his hard-hitting and controversial documentary series on Israeli settlements in the occupied territories. When we come back, we'll get a response from Barry Rubin, columnist for the Jerusalem Post. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We've been talking tonight with Chaim Yavin. He's often called the Walter Cronkite of Israel. He's come out with a new and controversial five-part, very personal documentary called Land of the Settlers. Came out May 31st, not carried by Channel 1, the Israeli state television station where he has worked for decades, but by a commercial channel. The state TV channel would not carry it. But it's come out, and it's made quite a splash in Israel and beyond Israel. For some reaction to Chaim Yavin's personal journey through the land of the settlers, we turn now to Tel Aviv and Barry Rubin. He's director of global research and international affairs, the International Affairs Center. He's a columnist for the Jerusalem Post, author of Yasser Arafat, A Political Diary. Barry Rubin, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
What's your sense of the splash that Chaim Yavin's documentary has made in Israel?
Well, I think there are some points that didn't come up. The first issue is that it was discussed, is it appropriate for the anchor person on the news to give a very clear advocacy piece? You know, that, in other words, if a reporter had done it, I don't think it would have been anywhere near as controversial. But the fact is, you know, he is the main presenter, and I think that gave it a lot of, and frankly, I don't think it was appropriate for him to give what is a very, very political, very ideological statement, even though I want to make it clear that actually I agree with him politically, but in a professional point of view, I question that. Secondly of all, another very big issue that really wasn't touched on is there was an attempt, I think, to make settlers look as bad and crazy as possible, and I think that's the truth. There are approximately 130,000 people who can be called settlers. They're of all political viewpoints, probably more than half of them are basically people who are not ideological settlers, but are simply people who bought a house that's on the other side of the Green Line. Or as a friend of mine said, I live in Israel and I'm looking for a parking space, and sometimes I park two blocks away, which is on the other side of the line. If you look at, for example, how settlers vote in the elections and so on. So what he did was he went for the most extreme stereotype. He interviewed the craziest people, and did not interview more moderate voices. I mean, we know, for example, that according to polls, a pretty high proportion of settlers in the West Bank said, if there's a peace agreement, we'll leave.
Yeah, of course, he's not talking to those, or didn't talk to those who were in the kind of bedroom suburb settlements, but rather those on the sort of leading edge, the ones furthest in, closest to Palestinians, I guess.
Okay, fine. But the point is that this was presented as a portrait of the settlers, and people objected to it because it didn't correspond with the reality they knew about. Now, in addition to that, I mean, some of these things are no great revelation. I mean, and we know, you know, if you want to talk to most extreme people, you go to a place like Hebron, or you go to Alon Moreh. I mean, you know how to do it. And if you want to make people look bad, a veteran journalist knows how to do it.
Let me ask you about one simple factual thing, if I may. You said 100-some thousand settlers. Of course, the numbers that we read are different. 230,000 Israelis living beyond the 1967 boundary lines, 200,000 or so in East Jerusalem, 8,000 or 9,000 in Gaza. What's the distinction you're making there?
I mean, I'm looking at government statistics, and I was referring particularly to the West Bank and Gaza. But the exact number was not my point. The point was the proportions who hold different views. And the fact is that most of the people in Gaza Strip made deals to leave. As I was pointed out earlier in your program, these are not the people who were demonstrating. But there were two issues of controversy, and I think they were legitimate issues of controversy about the documentary. But, I mean, for him to say things like people have to understand, you know, compromise is necessary and has to be a Palestinian state, I mean, this is clear. I mean, I would say that 80% of the Jewish population of Israel, which would make it about 90% of the overall population are ready to have a Palestinian state, are ready to leave, but they were before, ready to leave all of Gaza Strip, most of the West Bank. People have accepted this, and as you might guess, the demonstrations and disruptions are frankly pushing people, the great majority of the population, even further in that direction. No one could have done a more effective job of alienating and antagonizing mainstream Israelis than the settler movement has done in the last 3 weeks. And there are many people, I'm sure, among the settlers who realize this and are very upset over what extremists have done.
So where do you see this movement heading? Chaim Yavin describes it as very politically powerful, yet now there's clearly a gap with Ariel Sharon and, as you say, some alienation going on with the broader Israeli public. How do you assess the fundamental strength of the extremist edge that he's looking at here of the settlement movement?
I don't think the settler movement is politically powerful. It's politically powerful in the 70s and into the 80s. Its day has long passed. Gush Emunim fell apart long ago. When the Oslo Agreement was signed, which after all was 12 years ago, that people understood what that meant. I think that he's talking out of experience, and a lot of the things he's saying are in the past. But certainly what's happening every day is reducing, in my opinion, sharply the support. And you see, the problem is, I mean, it was really fascinating to listen to Chaim, and he expressed so well a view of a large strata of Israelis. They don't want the conflict to go on. Mm. They don't want to be in the West Bank and Gaza. They want to live in peace. They don't want to have terrorism,
right,
et cetera, et cetera. So it's only natural then for people who have that view to say there must be something we can do. And I wish very much, very passionately, that that was true. But the problem really is that as Israel withdraws from the Gaza Strip, which I support, that Hamas is saying this is a victory for us, for terrorism, and we should increase the attacks. Unfortunately, we're not talking about Palestinian politics here, but I think that the nature of Palestinian politics makes it impossible at the present time for any leader to do much. Coupled with the strategy of Abu Mazen, which is not to do much, it's very difficult to do much. If Israel behaves better, if it withdraws, if it says these words, then the problem will go away. And the problem is that the problem isn't going to go away because the Islamists and a very large portion of the nationalist portion of the Palestinian movement is still intending to destroy Israel and supports terrorism. Not Abu Mazen, not other people in the leadership, but that's the reality and the media incitement. So this hope that by behaving well and by doing this and by doing that, the problem's going to go away, it's going to happen. Now, obviously, people still want to behave well. They want to do the right thing. And that's one of the reasons why the withdrawal is as popular as it is, because people say, okay, Israel's out of Gaza, it's not responsible, and so we're not doing anything bad, and we're showing the world that we want peace. And that's a large portion. But what happens 4 months, 6 months from now, if rockets are still being fired, if mortars are being fired, if the Palestinian Authority people don't try to do anything to stop it, if terrorism is increased from the West Bank because of the belief, oh, this is a great victory, so now we're going to force them to do this, that the Europeans especially don't recognize that Israel has taken a risk and made a sacrifice but simply makes more demands, then people's view of the action that's been taken, i.e. the withdrawal, is not going to be as positive as it is now. But it's going to happen. I think it's a proper step, but we have to understand it not from the point of view of wishful thinking, but from the point of view of political analysis. I only hope that people recognize that this is a step for peace. It is a risk for peace. It is placing people's lives in jeopardy. It is, as Chaim Yavin pointed out, a very difficult emotional thing. And once again, Israel is trying to prove to the world that it wants a lasting and just peace, and I only hope that the world understands that and notices it.
How far do you see withdrawal ultimately going? And is Ariel Sharon prepared to withdraw enough settlers to make it possible for a Palestinian leader to declare this a just situation?
Well, okay, that's a complicated look. The analysis of the Sharon government is, and they've stated this, and by the way, it's a coalition government now with Labor Party.
Right.
The analysis is follows. Realistically, there is not a Palestinian leadership that's going to make a comprehensive peace. I think that's a correct analysis. We are in an interim period. How can we live in this interim period to keep the door open, arriving peace in the future?
Well, they won't make a peace because they're not strong enough to make a peace, you're saying?
No, they won't make a peace because Hamas, Islamic Jihad, the DFLP and the PFLP, and probably a majority in Fatah still has the goal of destroying Israel. And this is what they teach in the schools and what they say on radio and television and what they say in the official Fatah publications. And this is what they're training people to believe. Now, that is a big problem. In addition to that problem is the weakness of leadership and its choice of a strategy not to make problems. I mean, the first point of the roadmap, the commitment of the Palestinians, is to stop terrorism. They do literally nothing to stop terrorism. They don't stop attacks before they happen. They don't arrest people afterward. They don't expel Fatah people from the organization who committed terrorist attacks. They're doing literally nothing, and there is no ceasefire. And this is the reality, and people here know that this is the reality. So this is, given the fact that there's not going to be a comprehensive agreement, how can you build an interim? And so the interim is, you know, that you have to pull out of everywhere you can. You see what happens. Look, if the Palestinian Authority were to take over Gaza, set up a government, work to raise the living standards of the people, and try to stop terrorism and stop anti-Israel incitement. I mean, where we have the official PA chief cleric declaring that all Jews should be wiped off the face of the earth in the Friday sermons broadcast on Palestinian Authority media. Okay, if they set up a stable government that works on living standards, that stops terrorism, what are people going to say in Israel? They're going to say, wow, they're ready for peace, let's make more compromises. And what are people going to say if the incitement continues and they don't try to stop terrorism and the terrorism, in fact, increases? They're going to say, well, you know, this is a different situation. So to do as much as possible. Now, the fact is that the current government, which is the government of by Ariel Sharon and Shimon Peres, is ready to make a comprehensive peace agreement recognizing an independent Palestinian state, and as it's historically been phrased, the 67 borders with minor modifications. Minor modifications may mean 5%, 6%, 7%. Mm. Although people aren't talking about it now, that state will have its capital in East Jerusalem. So they're ready. They may not be giving as much as Barack offered, but they're probably giving, you know, 85 to 90% as much. And if you get further down the road, they may end up in the same place. This is a great opportunity for the Palestinians to show that they want peace, that they'll try, and then there'll be a response and we'll make progress.
A final thought, Haim Yavin says he sees ultimately here a Greek tragedy. He says he doesn't see a solution, much as he clearly yearns for one. Do you?
It's not a problem to visualize the solution. The solution is two states for two people, a boundary line that's mutually acceptable. Palestinians, if they're nationalists, will say that they want Palestinians to live in the state of Palestine and that they prevent people from crossing the border to attack Israel. I mean, that's a solution. You know, we know that's the solution. The problem is how to get there. And the problem is, if you look at Israeli politics, Ariel Sharon has become the Israeli de Gaulle. 80% of the population plus is ready for this. And the problem is on the Palestinian side, both because of weakness of the post-Arafat leadership and ideological extremism, they're not ready. And you're going to see this, unfortunately, in the weeks to months to come. But I don't think, even with the problems, that 6 months from now people will say, we're sorry we did the redeployment. I think they'll say, well, it didn't turn out as well as we'd hoped, but we're still glad that we did it.
Well, a cry from the heart from Israel's Walter Cronkite, Haim Yavin, and a critique here from a friend, Barry Rubin. Barry Rubin, director at the Global Research and International Affairs Center, columnist for the Jerusalem Post. Thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
In a moment, President Bush prepares to name his pick for the United States Supreme Court. This is On Point. In just a few minutes, President Bush is expected to announce his first nominee to the U.S. Supreme Court. About an hour ago, a name was leaked to the press, Judge John G. Roberts, Jr. of the U.S. Court of Appeals, D.C. Circuit. Deborah Rosenberg is national correspondent for Newsweek magazine. She's been reporting on the Supreme Court and joins me now from Palo Alto, California. Deborah, what can you tell us about Judge Roberts?
Well, Judge Roberts, it's interesting. He's sort of the consummate Washington insider. He is and has been for the last 2 years a judge on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which is considered sort of a feeder court in a way for the Supreme Court. He is thought to be incredibly intellectual, very smart, went to Harvard, Harvard Law School, clerked for Justice William Rehnquist on the Supreme Court, and worked in the Reagan Justice Department, and worked also in the Solicitor General's office under the first President Bush.
A solid GOP conservative, but conservative enough to satisfy President Bush's right-leaning backers? Too conservative to get through a Democratic the Democrats in the Senate?
The interesting thing about Judge Roberts is that he doesn't have a long record on the bench that the Democrats are going to be able to pick apart. There are a few things that liberal groups are already pointing to. One case in which he, in a 1990 brief, he called for overturning Roe versus Wade. But in a later confirmation hearing, when he got on the appeals court, he said he considered it law, settled law. So I think there'll be something for people to pick at, but not as much as with some of the other candidates.
And Deborah, you've been following this. How do you interpret this selection? Of course, many names were flying around earlier today. We heard a lot about Edith Clement in the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans. How do you interpret what President Bush is going for in judicial terms, in political terms?
It's interesting. I mean, when everyone thought that Chief Justice Rehnquist was going to step down, Roberts was at the top of the list of names we were hearing a few weeks ago. Then when it was O'Connor who stepped down, we started hearing a different set of names. And so it's interesting now that the president has come back apparently to settle on Roberts. I think that, you know, although he at least made a show of looking at a number of women candidates, that each one had their problems. Either they were too much of a blank slate, even for his conservative supporters, or they were too conservative in a very blatant way that he thought he'd have trouble getting through the Senate.
We'll hear much more in the next hour, I'm sure, and the president speaking shortly. But what is your sense of the kind of Senate reception that John Roberts is likely to receive?
I think there will be some moderate Democrats who will be open to him. Senator Joe Lieberman has apparently said that he's in the ballpark, whatever that means. I think, you know, it could come down to some issues like abortion. Where is he really on Roe versus Wade? And, you know, I don't know if we're going to get an answer to that.
He's 50 years old, replacing Senator Day O'Connor, if approved, who is, of course, 75. Can you see him playing the swing vote role that O'Connor played?
Well, it's tough to see that today, but few people would have predicted that of O'Connor when she was approved, you know, as well. I mean, she had a track record as being very conservative, and he does too. So, you know, it's often difficult to predict where these justices are going to end up once they get on the bench.
Well, the final word will be coming in just a few moments. President Bush preparing to appear in the East Room of the White House with, we are told, Judge John G. Roberts Jr. at his side. Deborah Rosenberg, national correspondent for Newsweek, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.